Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now for one of our conversations with leading strategists is retired United States Navy Admiral Mike Rogers, the former director of the National Security Agency, who is also the second commander of the U.S. Cyber Command, elevating that command into a combatant command. He is a consultant on cybersecurity and cyber, unsurprisingly, and he's also chairman of the advisory board of Clarity, a cybersecurity company. He started his career as a surface warfare officer before shifting to cryptology and became the first admiral from the Navy's information warfare community that was founded in 2009. This conversation is part of a series devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. Mike, thanks so very much for joining us.
Vago, thank you very much for the invitation. And thanks also for the remembering Andy Marshall. Boy, what an amazing mind. I had the good fortune of interacting with him several times in the course of my career when I was a mid-level officer. And I just loved learning and listening to what he had to say.
An absolutely extraordinary American who had kind of a profound impact on me as well throughout my career, whether directly or through his through all the members, all the fine members of St. Andrews Prep. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, including these Marshall Series conversations. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Mike, let's start with the cyber domain, which is a bit mystifying to even senior military leaders, right? I mean, there are folks who say, hey, I'm a naval officer, but I picked up air warfare, both within the confines of the Navy or working with the Air Force, and I did Iraq and Afghanistan deployments, so I get Army and I can speak Army or Spec Ops or even Intel. But cyber remains something still mystifying as a domain. And one would argue that given the former Commandant of the Marine Corps, Bob Neller, would often say that the United States was actually at full-blown war in cyber for more than a dozen years. I mean, this was now, right? It was, he would say 10 years, and that was like 3 or 4 years ago. It's obvious we've got to be doing a better job at this. And in order to do a better job at it, we have to better understand it. What's the right way for folks to be thinking of cyber as an operational and full-up warfighting domain in its own right, as opposed to just a support function or kind of a boutique capability?
Right. I thought the idea of an operational domain was a very important concept, because my argument, it wasn't just me, there were many out there who felt the same. My argument always was, look, cyber is an operational domain in which we execute a variety of very traditional operations. We maneuver, we do fires, we do reconnaissance, we conduct offensive and defensive activities. Much like the physical domain, it has key terrain. That terrain is man-made, but there's key terrain. If you think about it as a kind of operational domain, it gives you a frame of reference that you can start to use to apply warfighting constructs and solutions. It helps give you an intellectual framework for how to think about, so what capability do I need? How would I apply it? How does this cyber domain interact, interface, connect with those other domains, land, air, sea, space? You just can't view it in isolation. You know, I always thought that was a challenge for some. And I felt I was lucky. As I started as a surface warfare officer, as you said, well before I became a Navy four-star in cryptology, I started as a surface warfare. And my takeaways from that six-year portion of my 37-year career always had a huge impact on me in the cyber arena, because my argument was, I think of cyber in many ways, just like I did the maritime environment, this all-encompassing series of oceans that are interconnected that span the globe, in which large portions of which territorial aspects are not recognized. It's free maritime space. It's not governed by the laws or the regulations of any one nation for significant portions of it. I the frame of references I used when I was a ship driver very much, I thought, helped me as a cyber operator, if you will.
And you know, the similarity is actually profound, right? Because, you know, all of these connective links are almost like sea lanes, right? And then there are areas that are outside those lanes that are sort of the uncharted waters. And, you know, unfortunately, unlike maritime, cyber is ungoverned, right? It has some norms, right? But not enough norms and rules of the road at this point.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. So what I always used to tell people is don't start from a premise that fundamentally cyber is so different that none of the other frameworks, none of the other traits of the domains or the legal frameworks that are inherent to them exist. Rather, start from a premise that said cyber has many in that operational domain, has many of the same characteristics, and in some cases, legal frameworks that we have applied in the domains of air, sea, space, land, and space. Start from a premise that much of that is also relevant to the cyber domain, and then ask yourself, so what's unique, what's different, and then how do we account for that? But don't start from a premise that says cyber is so fundamentally different, so fundamentally unique, none of the insights, none of the lessons, none of the constructs, none of the legal frameworks apply. I just thought that just creates so many problems when you want to go down that road.
So what are the differences, right? So you talked about the similarities. What are the differences that people should
bear in mind? So the differences are, number one, it is man-made. Number two, it has both a virtual and a physical component to it. You know, for example, when we were back in 2016, 2017, when we were wrapping up cyber efforts against ISIS, you know, one of the things I always tried to remind the team was, so we're looking at target sets that have both a virtual and a physical dimension to them. What do I mean? I said, hey, this server we're going after, this router we're going after, we're going to access it via one of two ways. We can use the network and the global construct that's been put in place, and we can do it virtually. Or remember that server, that router, it physically exists somewhere in a physical domain on the planet. So if we can't access it virtually, don't forget that physical destruction via physical means is also another potential view. So try to look at target sets from both a virtual and a physical aspect and use the path that makes the best sense given the target.
So speaking of targeting takes us to the notion of threat. Threats have driven the development of our formidable capabilities right across the cyber and intelligence enterprises for good reasons. But nations like China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran have also now built considerable capabilities, right? You do something, your adversary does something. And now we even have private firms that are increasingly in the offensive cyber game, for example, for a whole bunch of deniability or even for corporate reasons. And we had a tendency sometimes of saying, the Chinese, they're really clumsy, or, you know, the Russians are kind of obvious, or, you know, well, the reality is they're good enough to get into some of our secure networks and stay there, right? And we can't eject them. So that shows a level of capability that's worrying. And they've gotten so good that a very good friend of mine who knows a lot about this stuff told me a few years ago, look, the Chinese aren't even reading our mail anymore because they already know so much about us, they feel they don't have to read our mail. And that's positively terrifying if you think about it, right? Mm-hmm. Before you can address the threat, you really have to know it and understand it. How do we need to be thinking about this threat, about our adversaries and their capabilities, nation state or otherwise?
So first, there's a range of capabilities out there, and there is a range of motivations. So one of the things I always tried to start with was, let's understand what is the strategy, what is the motivation for a nation state, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. What drives them, what shapes them, and how do they apply cyber? Because if we can understand the strategy, if we can understand what is shaping their efforts, that can start to help us from a defensive standpoint. We can start to anticipate, and we can start to make risk-based decisions about where do we make investments, where do we position capability, what do we prioritize and focus on. So if you look at the Russians, for example, they tended to view cyber from a couple lenses. Number one, cyber is an element of a broader disinformation effort. You saw that play out in 2016. You've seen they use that playbook before. but cyber is an element of a broader disinformation effort designed to weaken our institutions, to keep us fractured as a society, and to stop us from achieving cohesion and political will, in part because their view is a divided America is much less capable and is much less responsive to Russian activities in different parts of the world. The second part of cyber for Russians, in addition to this as an element of the disinformation piece, and I'm not trying to prioritize this at all, they also viewed cyber as a tool to place at risk capabilities that they felt in the event of a crisis or confrontation with the United States. And if they could place those capabilities at risk, it would create advantage for them strategically, right, to the military, and as well as militarily. That's why you saw them looking at the power grid. That's why you saw them at times in the energy sector and in the financial sectors. The third element for the Russians for cyber was as a military tool and as an espionage tool. Penetrating systems to generate insights, as espionage, but also trying to put military capability at risk to give them operational advantage in the event of a crisis or confrontation from a military perspective. If you look at China, very different in some ways. China viewed cyber, continues to view cyber in many ways, as an element of a broader national strategy designed to achieve strategic advantage in the core technologies they believe will lead to advantage economically as well as militarily and politically, the technologies that they think will lead to advantage in the 21st century. So think about AI, think about quantum, think about 5G, machine learning. That's this whole idea of intellectual property theft. China views cyber as a tool, among other things, to steal the intellectual property that they think will lead to strategic advantage for them. You don't see the Russians doing that to the same extent. You didn't see the Iranians doing that to the same extent of the North Koreans. That was really the biggest differentiator with the Chinese. They really viewed cyber in a strategic element of a broader national prioritization, a broader national effort on the part of China to achieve advantage at an economic and a technical level that, quite frankly, the other nations really weren't interested in. Likewise, they also viewed cyber as a way to potentially negate U.S. military advantage, U.S. military capability, a little bit like the Russians. They too, at times, were looking at critical infrastructure in the United States, but I would argue the Russians are a little more focused, a little more aggressive in that arena. If you look at the North Koreans, again, they're a little unique because what differentiated them was in part because of their strategic situation. Because they are so isolated, not just physically, but financially, for example, because of the sanctions, which have precluded their ability to use the world financial structure to move money through the SWIFT backbone, which is the architecture that enables the global economies and the nations of the world to move money in transactions. Because they're denied access to that through the sanctions that have been imposed by the US and the UN, they've been really isolated. And so money has become a huge issue for them. They're the only nation state that I ever saw use cyber as a tool to generate revenue. So they were into mining cryptocurrency. They were into stealing from banks by breaking into them, penetrating their networks and removing money. They were into gambling sites, betting sites, to see if they could break in and steal money. I never saw another nation who thought of cyber in quite the same way. They also view cyber as a tool to be used against, you saw them very active with cyber as a tool against the South Koreans. And they also use cyber as a tool to try to generate insight and knowledge with both some of their military applications and some of their economic activities. So for example, they were really interested in research in core areas within the US educational structure, for example, looking at what research was going on in universities in areas that was of interest to them. And then lastly, I would highlight the Iranians, a bit of a hybrid of China and Russia. Again, you didn't see them use it as a tool to generate money, even though they are isolated from sanctions. But what you saw them was cyber a tool to reach out in an asymmetric way, in a way that gave them some measure of plausible deniability, to attempt to put at risk capabilities in the U.S. So we saw them, you know, around dams, the financial structure, et cetera. We've also seen them use cyber offensively to degrade, destroy, or disrupt oil and natural gas production capabilities in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates. So every nation's a little different. Every nation also not only different in terms of their strategy, but their risk calculuses at times. China's been the most interesting to watch. Go back 10 years ago. Quite frankly, they just didn't seem to care if they got caught. Their tradecraft was not particularly quiet. They were very aggressive. You have to go back to when the U.S. called them out. We reached an agreement with them about how they wouldn't use cyber as a tool to break in, steal intellectual property, and then turn it over to their industries to generate commercial advantage. They seemed to stop for a while, but then quickly generated, got back into it, except when they got back into it, you could tell the strategic direction from the leadership was clearly very different. They changed their tradecraft. Their risk tolerance was very different. They weren't loud as much anymore, much more focused on not getting caught. Again, it all varies a little bit by the actor. But the bottom line is there's a wide range of capabilities out there, all of which offer potential threats to us and which we need to be concerned about.
We have a new administration that's coming in. Obviously, the Secretary of Homeland Security, the designee, Alex Mayorkas, is somebody who's got a cyber background. There are going to be a lot of folks who are saying that cyber is going to be a focus of this administration. Trump administration instituted National Security Presidential Memorandum 13 that was earlier this year. It was in the works for a long time, known as Defend Forward. And strategists have been saying we need a more declaratory cyber strategy to improve deterrence. What's the strategy, Mike, that we need? How do we need to build on Defend Forward? Do we need to be more declaratory? And increasingly, do we need to be signaling more capability to increase that deterrent edge? I mean, what's the right way to get to a better place here at the end?
Jack, so number one, there's no single element here that fixes everything. There's multiple dimensions to this. I always encourage people to think about cyber from a multi-initiative standpoint, that there's not one single thing you're going to do that's going to change the whole dynamic. Rather, it's a series of activities both in cyber and outside cyber that have the greatest potential to achieve a better end state for us, the U.S. So for example, I thought there was value in both acknowledging cyber capability, both offense and defense, as well as showcasing some of that capability. So in my time, for example, when we started the use of cyber against ISIS, you know, one of my comments to the Secretary of Defense was, sir, we need to publicly acknowledge we're doing this. I want the adversary to know we're going to contest them in every domain that's out there. And quite frankly, it's of value to us, in my opinion, for the rest of the global actors out there to be aware we have offensive capabilities and we are prepared and will use them under what we think are the appropriate circumstances within a very structured legal framework. But they should know we've got capabilities and we're prepared to use them. I think that's of value. I think in some ways this idea of trying to get to norms of behavior, the challenge at times, I thought, and again, I was part of two administrations, the Obama team and the Trump team. I thought at times we were so focused on trying to gain an international consensus that we were starting way too large. I thought, start with a core number of norms of behavior that we think would have wide acceptance. Start with a cadre of like-minded nations. The Five Eyes construct, for example, I always thought was a good departure point. And then let's build this out over time. But let's stop burning time, hoping that, you know, until we can get 200 nations to sign up to an agreement, we're not going to go down this road. I just thought at times that that's not the smartest way to do it. I also think as we're looking at this, the Solarium Commission, I thought they did a great job laying out some thoughts on deterrence in cyber, where there are some elements of deterrence from other domains that are relevant. But on the other hand, just blindly saying, hey, if it worked in the nuclear arena, it works for cyber. I don't agree with that approach. But I think there are some things that we can take from previous thoughts on deterrence in other domains and then build on that. And I thought the Solarian Commission did a good job laying out what are the three primary components of what a deterrence concept might look like within cyber. I think the other thing is don't allow cyber to intimidate you. If I had a dollar every time I'm sitting in the White House sit room in my previous life, and I kept hearing from the senior most leadership of the government, well, Mike, we live in a glass house, so we really can't do anything here because people will, we're too vulnerable. And my comment was that is totally the wrong way to look at this. Everybody lives in a glass house. Every nation, our core competitors, I don't care if it's the Russians, the Chinese, they have massive vulnerability just like we do. Could you tell me how we let ourselves get into a situation where the Russians, the Iranians, the Chinese, and the North Koreans use cyber as a low-risk option that gives them great benefit, but yet will not trigger a significant response to the United States, from the United States? And at the same time, we have come to the conclusion cyber is a high-risk potential option, and therefore we shouldn't even consider it. I said, this is crazy. It goes to something that you've said to me before, Vago, and that's, you know, this idea of, so what is normal peacetime? What does wartime or crisis look like in cyber? Well, I can remember one time, one of those days where it was just a long day and I'm forgetting where I am and who I'm talking to. And I kind of lost it for a minute and said, well, if you think this is what peacetime looks like in cyber, tell me what you think war is going to look like, because I don't view this, the dynamics we're currently in cyber, I don't view this as normal peacetime activity in the same way I'm watching activity in those other operational domains, maritime, air, land, space. Cyber is a different kettle of fish. So could we think about this at times a little differently and stop using these analogies about phase zero, phase one, crisis versus peace? I said, you know, I'm not sure that that is the best framework for us to understand, categorize, and react to activities that we're seeing in cyber. Put another way, if our strategy is going to be totally passive and we are just going to respond to the activities of adversaries, that is a losing strategy. My 37 years in the military always taught me I want to shape the choices and the risk calculus of my adversary. I want to shape and drive them to make choices that actually complement my strategic vision, that complement, you know, our strategic outcomes. Why would we want to keep playing to their view of the world? I never did quite understand that. But that's just one person's perspective. Well,
no, but I mean, I think it's a very important perspective, right? And as you said, right, it's not just in cyber. There are tool sets you can use in cyber, but you have sanctions you can do. You can do diplomatic moves. You can shift also into a much more military posture that, again, backs up this notion of sort of the continuum, the shape. And, you know, right, allies and partners, you focused on working on allies and partners because their edges are our edges at the end of the day. Is there, let me go to the question of conflict and what it looks like, right? So we've got Bob Neller. You know, Bob Neller's statement when he made it was certainly a powerful one. Those of us who were paying attention to the space knew it was much, much more contested and sporty, even if, you know, the overwhelming guidance was, you know, don't discuss a lot of this in public. This is, you know, and that sense that we have to be careful. We live in a glass house. But we have a tendency of thinking of warfare really in the way we want to fight, which is platform-based, right? I mean, we have the same platforms today that we did in World War II. They're just all a lot better. But the thing is, our adversaries may actually be planning to fight us in a very, very different way. And what you see in cyberspace is evidence of that different way of engaging. And you can achieve kinetic effects through cyber, right? The Stuxnet, I'm not asking you to comment on it, but Stuxnet was one of those things that it has a physical impact. And it should a nation state want to not just hack a dam, but actually put malicious code in that destroys turbines or causes mass flooding. I mean, there's a lot of casualties you can cause in fairly short order. How do we need to think about what, Mike, a great power war would look like and what it would look like in cyber, and the reality that actually an enormous amount of it might actually be cyber with kinetic effects as opposed to kinetic, purely kinetic, right? The Mahanian clash at sea, because even right. A Mahanian clash at sea could have a very powerful cyber component that compromises a major fleet unit to make sure it doesn't move that far before the hypersonics arrive, for example.
Yeah, so when I look at the characteristics of conflict, of war in the 21st century, a good deal of it remains, you know, fairly unchanged. But I think there are some core differences. I think back about the nature of a war fight as I left versus the nature of the war fight when I started 37 years before. One of the things I look at is I think speed becomes a huge war fighting advantage in this 21st century. The ability to react faster, the ability to adapt faster, the ability to detect faster. I think speed becomes a huge advantageous characteristic. So as I'm looking at the DoD, for example, one of the things I would be arguing is we need to think about how speed becomes a differentiator for us, becomes an advantage for us. A second characteristic, I think, is going to be the power of data, and speed's related to this. The warfighters that can turn data into knowledge and insight the fastest, I think, have a huge advantage in this globally interconnected world that we're living in. Again, you can argue speed's an element of it, but I think the data piece becomes really important here. And it's not a part that we traditionally thought of so much from a warfighting aspect, if that makes sense. We tended to view that more as an IT or a support kind of function, much less as a core warfighting function. As you said, I always thought one of the challenges, we are all captive in many ways of history and culture. And our history within the American warfighting construct has historically been shaped by a focus on platforms. And I'm not sure that, I think what we need to do is shift to a focus of on capabilities and then ask ourselves, what's the best way to apply, what's the best way to bring those capabilities to bear? It may be a platform, but I don't start out with a premise that says, well, we have these things called aircraft carriers. So what can we do to make them more relevant? My attitude is, I'm not arguing that's a bad thing, but my fundamental starting premise is, so what are the capabilities I need to bring to bear to gain advantage on the battlefield? And then what are the best ways to do that? And there may be a role for some platforms in doing that, but I don't start from a thought process that says, I got to build my strategy around platforms. And yet historically, that's the way we tend to think because it's been very effective for us in the past. I don't think that that's going to be as effective for us in the future. And you can see some nations, look, the Russians tried to, it's a little bit of ancient history now, but the Soviets tried to challenge us head to head. And in the Cold War, they ultimately imploded economically first and then politically, and the Soviet Union, the USSR, no longer exists as a result of that activity because they thought they could compete with us head to head from an economic and a military perspective. And quite frankly, it bankrupted them. I watched, and you look at how they pivoted now, they have totally changed their strategy. They are not focused now on head-to-head maritime supremacy against the United States or achieving strategic preeminence in the aviation or the land domains. Rather, they have said to themselves, how can I strike quickly and strike at an overwhelming level that induces the Americans to not respond because they'll feel the price is too high. So they, in fact, some ways they're going back. You look at at Russian nuclear strategy now, it's like the 1950s and the early 1960s. Right. They believe that you can employ nuclear weapons in a tactical level and not trigger a massive retaliation threshold. So look at the kind of weapons, the kind of capabilities they're developing. You know, that's the way they're trying to fight. They've decided they got to go asymmetric to some extent and how they tie in the information domain. It doesn't mean they've walked away from traditional military capabilities, but if you look at what they're investing their money in right now, it is not to replicate the spectrum of military capabilities that they had 40 years ago. If you look at the Chinese, I would argue they're in an interesting evolution. They, first of all, they studied us. You read Chinese military writings from our time in the Balkans through our campaigns in the Middle East. They tore them apart and tried to identify what was it that gave the Americans and by extension their allies this huge military and warfighting operational and strategic advantage. They broke that down into a series of capabilities and insights, and they said to them themselves, so the answer isn't necessarily to replicate the Americans' capabilities in terms of the range of those capabilities. It's to figure out how we can negate those capabilities. How do we take out this amazing command and control capability we have that the Americans have? How do we negate this ability to extend logistics support to support force employment at hemispheric distances halfway around the world? How do we cripple that logistics backbone so they can't support a fight at huge differences across the Western Pacific? How do we negate this huge situational awareness advantage the Americans have between their ISR capabilities, whether they be in the traditional arena or on orbit, for example? How do we take that away? How do we negate this global communications capability they have? So you've watched them really focus on investing in capabilities designed to take that away from us. What I find really interesting is look how they're starting to pivot a little bit from that. You are now watching them not only focus on negating our strengths, but they are the only nation in the world, I would argue right now, that is actually trying to develop a full spectrum of capability designed to take us on in almost every arena. Right. You look at what they are doing in terms of ground armor and mechanized capabilities for their ground forces. You look at what they're doing with fifth generation and stealth fighter technology. You look at what they're doing with precision strike and long range strike. Look at what they're doing in the maritime environment, both in the surface, in carrier aviation, in the subsurface world. They are a bit of a hybrid. They want to go asymmetric, and increasingly they're saying to themselves, and we can beat them symmetrically. I don't think, when I look at China, I don't want to get into the same situation we found ourselves with the Soviets, where the Soviets were on the wrong end of the cost equation. I don't want the US to be on the wrong end of the cost equation here. We cannot buy ourselves into achieving military supremacy with China. That's not going to be the strategy that's going to work for us. Rather, I think we need to step back and say, how do we build on those investments we've already made? But what are the investments we need to make in areas that will give us new advantage that can negate some of those things the Chinese are doing? And the answer isn't, well, just build more platforms. That is not a winning strategy for us, I don't think.
You know, it's an excellent point you made, because it's funny. I mean, the series is named for Andy Marshall, and there were people and some of Andy's disciples would point that the people who most learned Andy's lessons were actually in Beijing and in Moscow, and less so in that his lessons were not as broadly followed, or advice necessarily was followed. Funny enough, in Washington. So, what are some of the capabilities that we need to be investing in from your standpoint to try to turn these tables, right? Because deterrence works only so far as the adversary thinks you're developing the capabilities to stymie them. If they get a sense that you're not developing those capabilities, is where you get into problematic terrain and deterrence fails, right? So what are the capabilities that you think are going to be those value add? Because in a battle space like cyber, that extends to your and my civilian computers, right? I mean, a Chinese official once told me, you know, when I raised the issue of them stealing American technology, he was like saying, well, surely if you valued it, you'd protect it. And you guys don't really protect it very well. So it was kind of a dumbfounding gall, you could say. But on the other hand, he was right. Some of this technology was not being defended in part in any concerted fashion, right? So, I mean, what, how do we need to think about countering those capabilities in a meaningful way, both militarily as well as nationally? I know that's kind of a big question, but...
Yeah, let me think about... Let me first, when you look at China from a strategic perspective, let's look at what characteristics technologically, culturally, the kind of investments they're making, what are their potential vulnerabilities that we can turn to our advantage? So when I look at them, I see a culture that is very centralized. I see a culture that tends to be, and you see this in the warfighting regimes, very top-down driven. I see a culture that does not like to admit mistakes. I see a warfighting construct that does not, for example, you're watching the Chinese start to project military capability at greater and greater distances, and yet they do not have the same kind of global infrastructure that we do. I'd like to keep it that way. I'd like to try to slow them down and their ability to generate, you know, logistics capability and infrastructure around the world. I look at China and I see a nation that has no really, you can argue Pakistan maybe, but has no real strategic alliances. That's a huge strength for us. Again, I want to keep it that way. I don't want them to build a strategic alliance structure, and I want us to reinforce the value of our strategic alliance structure and the relationships that we have created. I want to slow down and create confusion within their structure. So if you look at the ability to degrade their command and control, the ability to degrade their communications, the ability to degrade their situational awareness, so they have an incomplete picture, because again, in my experience, those are areas they don't respond well to. Those are the kinds of capabilities that I would be investing in. So think about cyber, think about long-range precision strike. Think about not having to put my platforms within their physical primary battle space. How can I get distance? How can I gain time? How can I put capabilities on those platforms? Because you're not going to walk away from the literal, we have made trillions of that. We have trillions of dollars of fixed costs right now, fixed investment in those platforms. The solution is not we'll do away with them. I think the solution is how do we adapt them? How do we change our strategies? How do we build a strategy with the PRC, for example, that's not based around, let's go with the 1945 model like we did at the end of the war with the Second World War with Japan, and we're going to operate massive maritime formations in the waters around China in the event of an armed conflict. I'm like, given the Chinese capabilities, I'm not sure that's a pretty high risk strategy and it's got a high cost. I'm not sure that's the smartest way to go about doing this. On the other hand, if we can match long range capabilities, whether it be sensors, whether it be weapon systems, whether it be using platforms to host autonomous vehicles and autonomous sensors that can operate at extended ranges, so those platforms don't have to physically be in close proximity to the opponent, man, let's be smarter here. And you're already starting to see that evolution, particularly, I would argue, the subsurface world right now is doing some really interesting work in autonomous platforms, for example, using the submarine as a host. I think there's some really good lessons there. I also think we need to be much more, it's kind of the evolution of jointness to me. And again, I was in the military before Goldwater Nichols. I actually was in combat before Goldwater Nichols in Grenada. And I can remember my destroyer. I was a surface guy then. I ran the naval gunfire teams on that ship. We showed up. I'm off the Point Salinas airfield watching the 82nd, you know, roll out of C-130s. And literally, you could watch, we're only a mile off the end of the runway, and you could visually watch them coming in, doing their low-level jumps out of C-130s and C-141s. And we're getting asked to do fires for the 82nd and for elements of the Ranger Battalion that were with them and for the Mu that was also part of this. And I'm thinking, I have never exercised with the 82nd. I've never worked with the Ranger Battalion. And when I did my naval gunfire certification for my ship, we never worked with the Mu. We did it on a range all by ourselves. So thus was born this whole idea of jointness. I think the evolution next is, how can you take jointness into a much more integrated kind of thing? I look at long range, you look at long range battlefield capabilities that the Army has, for example, ATACMs and other things. And I sit there and think to myself, why couldn't we host those on maritime platforms, for example?
Right.
Why couldn't we do this in a much more integrated way? You know, jointness has been, we each retain our core characteristics and we operate it in a collaborative way, but we operate still within a largely service-defined construct, and we bring those service-defined constructs together. I think one of the challenges as we're moving forward is, can we evolve from that into a much more, can we actually not just collaborate, but integrate multi-service capabilities into common platforms, into common warfighting capabilities? Now, you can't do it across the board. There are some differences, and we've seen the challenges before when you try to build one weapon system and make it work for every operating environment. Look at the F-111 as a good example, for example. But I do think there are some things that we can do differently. So I think cyber is a powerful tool in the warfighting construct of the 21st century, both from an offensive as well as from a defensive standpoint. Because don't forget, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, the North Koreans to a lesser extent, they are all using cyber as an offensive capability at a tactical level. Some of them are better at it than others. Some of them have integrated cyber more. I give the Chinese a lot of credit in that regard. I think they've got a really interesting, and quite frankly, I think it's a very effective warfighting construct with this idea of bringing the informational, the spectrum, and the cyber piece together into a single warfighting organization, and by extension, a single integrated warfighting construct. I think that's very powerful.
You know, you talked about important capabilities, right? And every once in a while, we have a tendency of eventually getting it right, and we make some big investments and big bets. The intelligence community was a true pioneer, whether looking at AI, computing, and even big data before it was big data, right? I mean, you guys were expert at that, and still are at a level that I think would boggle people, really. We are now at the cusp of true revolutions. One is artificial intelligence. The other is quantum computing. Hartmut Nevin of Google, who led the company's quantum supremacy team. And that is a truly game-changing capability. The Chinese are ahead of us in quantum communications, and they're right behind us in quantum computing. And Hartmut thinks that we're in 10 years, those people who have quantum will be aliens versus cavemen with linear computers, right? You can encrypt in a way that you can't decrypt. You can read everybody's messages that you've recorded over the past 20 years, for example, to really understand capabilities that you may have otherwise missed. And yet these are super weapons for which we do not readily appear to have any national strategy at the end of the day, right? A senior military officer told me, we have a nascent AI national strategy, and we don't really have a national quantum strategy. As somebody who's deeply knowledgeable about this entire space, what is the kind of national important strategy we need to have on this? Because I guarantee you there are more people looking at USS Gerald R. Ford than they are maybe at quantum. And quantum is a far more game-changing capability.
Yeah, so first let me just...
across the board.
Right, let me just start with a real quick basic... explanation, because I got this in Congress, in the White House, within the DOD. You know, Mike, why is quantum, what is unique or different about it? How can we justify this kind of investment? Current computational capability is built around something we call a byte or a bit. It has only two variables, a one and a zero, and it can only look at one variable at a time. Quantum computation is built around a building block called a qubit. A qubit can simultaneously be composed of more than two variables, and it can look at multiple variables simultaneously, not just one variable. What does that mean? Current computational capability, so if it looks at encryption, for example, or data sets that are huge with lots of changes, lots of variables, because it can only look at one variable at a time, there are inherent limitations. Quantum, because it can look at multiple variables simultaneously, will take the most complex, the biggest data sets, the data sets with the most variance that tend to change over time. And because it can look at multiple variables and multiple variables simultaneously, it processes so much faster. It is a game changer. This is not just, well, it's better. It's just an upgrade of the current system. No, it is fundamentally different. A qubit is fundamentally different than a byte, and it gives the quantum so much more. So you look at what the Chinese are doing. They have decided that there are key technologies that will lead to competitive advantage in the digital economies of the 21st century. AI, machine learning, 5G, quantum. We, and what they have done, our Chinese counterparts, is said to achieve that supremacy, we need an integrated national strategy that brings together the capabilities of the nation state, from espionage and theft of intellectual property and research being done by other nations, to their national laboratory system, to their educational structure, to their business community. They have aligned all of that in a single integrated focus on achieving advantage in quantum, and also ensuring that the global standards that are developed for the application of quantum over time are standards developed by China, not by the US and others. The US, on the other hand, we have always traditionally said, when it comes to core technologies, that's really the domain of the private sector. And government's pretty ineffective at times in terms of technology. And let's just stay away from it, and let's just let the private sector take care of all this. And my attitude is that only works when the playing field is level and it's US companies competing against Chinese companies. And instead, US companies right now are competing against this integrated national strategy on the part of China. So the answer for us in the US, I believe, is a much more integrated strategy between the government and the private sector in a way we're just not used to doing. But I think it's something we need to look at.
Without having you sort of stop sleeping at night and sort of resume facial tics, you were on the job during the Snowden aftermath. On the job during the OPM hacks. You were on the job during the Russian cyber operations of 2016. And you've discussed to a degree the importance of actually being stronger on this stuff. But sort of as a military commander, you also have to follow right civilian guidance at the end of the day. You may want to have done things that civilian leaders did not want to do. What were the key distilled lessons of all of those experiences that folks should really bear starkly in mind, right? I mean, there's an overclassification message in part because, you know, you guys kept, you couldn't be as open as you wanted to be. And with Snowden, you kept getting surprised by sort of the next thing that complicated messaging. But from your standpoint, what were sort of the key distilled lessons from all of this that can improve how we react and should act and should shape in the future?
So the OPM hack showed you the importance of data. What do I mean by that? One of the byproducts of this Chinese investment in AI and quantum and machine learning was they decided that given these capabilities they're developing, they needed to also bring together more data to feed them. And so the OPM database becomes really attractive. Because I can remember
a hotel database, exactly, or a credit card database.
That's why I say one of the takeaways from the OPM hack is the power and value of large data concentrations. And that's more than just what's in the government arena. And so there's a reason why you've seen nation states going after massive data holdings, OPM, hotels, health insurance. There's just a lot of unique personally identifiable information that combined with the processing, and learning capabilities of AI and machine learning, you generate knowledge and insight at a level that you historically haven't been able to do. So I would say that's the takeaway from that. When I look at the Snowden piece, number one, the challenge of the insider, you know, culturally the bias is, hey, we're all good people working hard, following the law, and we're serving our nation. The only challenge we got to deal with is outside. And one of my takeaways from the Snowden environment was, guys, guess what? We have a highly motivated workforce, but it's composed of humans, and humans sometimes make bad choices for a variety of reasons. We have to account for that, and we can't pretend that we're unique in that, and that therefore, because of our mission, because of our values, because of who we are, we don't have to worry about that. Didn't think so. The other thing I thought that Snowden highlights is we need to be willing to be more upfront about what we are doing. I always argued, look, what we need to protect is the how we do it. That gets into the TTPs, the tactics, techniques, and procedures. That's what we need to protect. The what we do is we need to be willing to have a much more public conversation. Because if you look, for example, at the call data record database or program under the Patriot Act that Snowden revealed, you know, I wasn't there at the time, but I had this conversation with, you know, DNI Clapper. Hey, why didn't we make this? It's been reviewed and enacted in laws by Congress twice. Why didn't we just publicly acknowledge that it was, as a result of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, we are developing a capability that's designed to enable us to tie together foreign activity with potential domestic activity by these same actors, and that we are using data provided to us by the phone companies that does not tell us the identity, does not tell us the location, and does not tell us the content of the calls? Why weren't we upfront about that? Instead, it came across as, oh, well, you guys are trying to hide something.
Right, feeding the tinfoil hat crowd, right?
But, which then just feeds this narrative that, look, in the American construct, we have a healthy distrust of government. We always have. That's only been exacerbated in the last decades by a broader distrust of institutions in general and government institutions in particular. And so we've got to ask ourselves, I don't think we can just say the answer is, well, don't worry about it. We know best. How do we account for that distrust? How do we attempt to address the concerns, which are very valid, of our citizens as to what their government is doing at the same time while we're also trying to protect the how we do it? Because if we can protect the how, we can continue to be effective in many ways.
I don't mean this to sound like it's a political question, but how do you fight disinformation, which is a very, very critical, right? I mean, that's the hypersonic weapon of the age, right? Russians spend $100-160 million and have tremendous strategic effects of exacerbating fractures and strains in American society. The trouble is that for the first time in a long time, the president of the United States and his allies and others in this ecosystem are willing to peddle and amplify that disinformation leading to misinformation. How do you fight this on a national level when the people who are in the ecosystem are actually, including at the highest levels, helping propagate it?
So number one, I think you start with a broad recognition that in fact, there are actors out there, both external and internal, that are attempting to turn this information dynamic as a vehicle to manipulate, to deceive, to alter identity, alter content, alter imagery. So you start out with a simple premise that says, look, I don't believe everything I read, see, and hear. I say to myself, how can I verify this? Where did it come from? Does this make sense with other things I'm seeing? This idea that because I saw something, a visual image, or because I read something, it must inherently be true or be accurate. Oh, man. You know, it's like, it's a little different, but the analogy I always like to use is, as a kid, I grew up in the city of Chicago, and you learned a set of survival skills about what neighborhood should you be in, not be in, what are the things that you should look for, broken windows, broken lights, vehicle activity, people on the street. You learned a set of cues that gave you a sense of, should I feel comfortable here? Should I not feel comfortable? And I'm only talking from a security standpoint. Likewise, I think we should use the same kind of thought process as we're looking at and taking in information. Lastly, we have got to force ourselves to get out of our comfort zone. The way media is today, both electronic, social, as well as the more traditional platforms, you can create an ecosystem that just becomes an echo chamber that just reinforces your worldview. You can do that if you want. That doesn't really help. Rather, I think we need to construct an information dynamic in which we aggressively look for a variety of viewpoints. And that's just not the norm in this polarized and very divided society we live in at the moment.
Because you're a 1610. For people who are paying attention, that was an old cryptologic officer, but now you're an 18 flag officer.
1810. I'm an 1810.
You're an
1810. Or I was, excuse me.
You were. But you were originally an 1110 for surface warfare officer. Surface and that warfare. takes me to my last question. You know, you, Mike, are a unicorn. You were the first person from the information warfare community to make flag. Mike Gilday,
well, obviously not to make CNO, flag, to be a four star.
To make four star. Sorry about that. Mike Gilday, former 10th Fleet commander, certainly has cyber experience, but his core expertise was as a surface warrior. How do we move away from training incredibly capable strategic unicorns to producing racehorses and workhorses across the force, given how important this skill set is? And you can't just have eaches of one and two really smart guys that the flag may or may not turn to and go, hey, the crypto guy back there, the intel guy, hey, what do you have to say about this? Instead of you're up front and there are more of you shaping how people should be thinking about an absolutely critical battle space where the lines are, again, starting at our iPad, moving all the way out to China's shore.
So I think it starts from a recognition that there is no one skill set that provides all the answers in the world of the 21st century. I don't care if it's a special warfare officer. I don't care if it's a surface warfare officer, an aviator. Look, there's no one skill set that has all the answers. So how do we build a construct that enables us to bring together a broad range of experiences and expertise to maximize the probability of successful outcome? I think it starts by this idea, and Mike Gilday is a great example of this, and I'd be the first to admit, I pushed hard, and I was the only one, but I pushed hard to make this happen. My argument at the time when I was US Cyber Command in particular was, I am not interested in a cookie cutter approach to building the cyber workforce of the future. Likewise, I believe that we need to ensure cyber is viewed as an area of exposure for all warfighting officers and warfighting professionals, regardless of rank. That cyber will be so foundational to the future, we all need some level of experience and knowledge in the area. Some would gain that through education. Some would gain that potentially through actually doing jobs and doing tours. But this idea we're all going to be a cookie cutter. So I thought Mike Gilday was a great example. I went to the CNO and said, look, my J3 slot is opening up. I want a post-strike group commander to be the J3 for US Cyber Command.
Right.
And when the initial response I got was, but they don't know anything about cyber. I said, as a J3, as an operations officer, I want somebody who understands risk. I want somebody who understands maneuver. I want somebody who understands how you apportion capability among multiple resources. I said, a strike group commander lives that every day. He or she may not be an expert on cyber. I got lots of people who are experts on cyber. I want that broader perspective. And so I think that broadly, we got to be willing to broaden exposures. And this idea of creating unique stovepipes, I am not a big fan of that at all. I mean, I pushed against the idea of a cyber service, for example. I said, look, I want cyber integrated into everything we do. I don't want to treat it as some stovepipe that some specialized group is responsible for, and therefore nobody else needs to worry about. I thought that's not a good way.
K through 12, our mutual friend Philip Niedermeyer talks about this all the time, about the importance of a real integrated K through 12 education. We've got kids, Mike, who are, you know, growing up with iPhones in their hand, but they're not nearly as cyber savvy as they need to be. You and I were talking about how somebody might be very, very responsible when they're on the job, even from the cyber community, but comes home and, you know, has an open router, for example. I mean, what's the kind of education we need to build that sort of national secure approach that we clearly don't have now?
So I think it's about how do we teach cyber fundamentals, particularly cybersecurity, at a very early age. Look, we're not going to turn everybody into a technical expert. We're not going to turn everybody into a software engineer. That's not what the focus should be. Rather, the focus should be, how do we ensure that the members of our society have a fundamental level of knowledge that enables them to operate in a secure and safe way from a cyber perspective in this digital world we all find ourselves in. To me, it's about focus on the basics, particularly the cybersecurity basics.
Sir, thanks very, very much for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure having you on. Look forward to having you on more often to talk about these kind of issues, because I think they're strategic. They're very, very important. And as a kid who grew up in New York City, I completely understand your Chicago calculus on how, you know, track while scan, you know, scan while tracking, and make sure that you're paying attention to what's happening. So certainly held you in good stead throughout your Navy operational and cyber career.
Thanks, Vago. Thanks very much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.